Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
This is The James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. I'll be with you until 3:30 p.m. going through the biggest stories of the day and this one that just broke in the last, probably about the last hour actually, because we'd almost reached the end of our preparations for the show, hadn't we, Kieran? We were sitting there going, oh yeah, we're quite well set for today, aren't we? We might get a few things done, do some fun things, then bang! This announcement lands on our desk. Well, obviously nothing ever lands on our desk anymore, but you know what I mean. And yes, Newcastle have confirmed that the talks with Rafael Benitez could not, and indeed, and this is quite pointed in the statement, would not result in a deal. Rafa Benitez is going to leave Newcastle, well, pretty much immediately at the end of his current contract. We understand he was offered an additional one-year deal, but with no changes to the structure of the contract, no changes to the transfer budget proposed, and no changes to how he might be able to have input on those transfers. You know, that Mike Ashley essentially stuck to his guns, and it means he has lost, realistically, the best manager he's ever had. You know, when you think about, there are a few names of guys who will never have to buy a drink in Newcastle. You know, Frank Clark, Bobby Robson, Jackie Milburn, Shea Given, Kevin Keegan, Alan Shearer, of course. And I think Rafael Benitez is among them. You know, they sing his name every week at St James's Park. Through everything that they've been through in his three-year tenure, he's always been popular. Because he's, I think, married into the concept of the club. I think he understands the club. And he's always played, to a certain extent, football that they've enjoyed. And he's also kind of been the counterpoint to Mike Ashley, who they've seen as someone who doesn't understand the club, an owner who doesn't get the club. So I think it's valuable, in his case, to be such a personable guy, I should say. And that, unfortunately, has caught up with Mike Ashley, I would suggest. His reign is over now, just two games short of Rafa Benitez's 100th in charge he's been dispensed with. Well, I don't know if that's even the right word. They were trying to come to an agreement, and they have not come to that agreement. And they've been forced to announce today that Rafa Benitez is indeed leaving the club. There is some irony, I believe, that if you go to the front page of nufc.co.uk, where the Rafa Benitez news is on the front page, it is not the first thing that comes up. If you go to the Newcastle United page, their own page, the very top photo and story is renew your season ticket for 2019-2020 now. Now, they really haven't thought that through, have they? Because one of the things, and reading a lot of the reaction on social media, one of the things that supporters have been saying is, well, that's it. I'm not renewing my season ticket now. Why would I? Benitez was the best thing about this club in terms of the people who've been involved with it. Take a look at Johnny Sharples, who we all know, what a big deal on social media, you might say, but also a Newcastle fan. He said, in a rare moment of absolute sincerity, Rafa Benitez always wanted what was best for the club and for the fans. He and Sir Bobby Robson are probably the only two top-level managers we've had come to this club. I sincerely doubt we'll have another for a long time. Cheers, Rafa. It's hard to argue with that, really. Because much as Newcastle is a very attractive prospect, you know, with its fiercely loyal fans, its massive attendances, its history in the game, it's hard to think that any manager at the top level would want to go there, given how little money's been on offer for Rafa Benitez. You know, you have to remember that, yeah, he broke Newcastle's transfer record with a guy no one had ever really heard of, Raul Almiron. Who was he? Who is he? You know, no one was really that enamoured with it when he decided he would be the man to break the transfer record. It's worthwhile pointing out, as someone already has on Twitter, that Alan Pardew's still got a year left on that eight-year contract he signed. Yeah, I mean, that's probably part of it as well for Newcastle fans, is that they had to put up with a man who they didn't want in terms of Pardew for so long. And now. And then they got Rafa, who was such an antidote to Alan Pardew. You know, Pardew, who was seen as aloof, arrogant, someone who didn't understand the club, and also seen as part of the sort of southern mafia, which they've often thought that Ashley was part of as well. So to then get Benitez, it was just, they instantly fell in love with him. People saying on Twitter that this club deserves way, way better. If you do want to tweet us, by the way, you can do so at Love Sport Radio, Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Or you can even drop us a WhatsApp message on 0208 70 20 558. What next for Newcastle? Or indeed, who next for Newcastle? 0208 70 20 558. Hilariously, I made a note to myself of the number. Because even though I've learnt the number, I thought I'd note it down anyway. And in my haste, I've written down my own mobile number. So at the top of my cue sheet for this show is my own mobile number. I won't be reading it out on air because, much as I love you all, I don't want you texting me at 3 in the morning. It's just not something I need in my life. But drop Love Sport a text on 0208 70 20 558. You can text them at 3 in the morning. The contenders, by the way, the current favourite for the Newcastle job, Gary Monk. Of course, just left Birmingham not long ago. We've also got Sean Dyche, Jose Mourinho mentioned there, Chris Hughton and Michael Appleton, the Leicester assistant manager, in there as well. Let's see what Laurie Callas, who's on the line now, he's a Newcastle fan. Laurie, I was going to say unexpected news, but it's not. I imagine you saw this coming.
Hi, James. Yeah, hope you're feeling better, by the way.
Thank you very much. I'm not, but, you know, I'm sure I'm not feeling as bad as you are.
No, I'm not going to lie, James. I'm absolutely devastated. And the shame about it is I can't really say that I didn't see it coming. You're absolutely right. We've had kind of vague hope throughout the summer, you know, trying to persuade ourselves that no news is good news. But really, I think everybody's known for the last week or so when there really hasn't been anything to smile about. The club's continued issuing no comment after no comment. And yeah, I'm just completely devoid of optimism now for next season, unfortunately.
I found it quite funny, a sort of wry smile came across my face when I went to the Newcastle website and the top story is currently renew your season ticket for 2019-2020 now. Do you know people who are going to actually vote with their feet here and not renew or not buy tickets for games next year?
Well, I do. I've spoke to someone this morning actually who has said that they've tried. They'd already renewed in anticipation of hoping Rafa would stay, and they've now are making the effort to retract that dedication to the club. Mm. I will be amazed if they sell any £65 worth most expensive in the league shirts, because I can't think of one Newcastle fan who's going to want to have anything to do with the commercial side of the club in the current situation that it's in.
Do you think this is going to become a bit of a Blackpool situation? You know, they very successfully boycotted their owner, but, you know, businesses around the stadium went bust. And do you think we could be seeing now a protracted process of almost, you know, a public litigation between fan and owner?
Oh, well, I don't know about that, James. I mean, there's still part of me that's hoping it's more of a Charlton situation where you have this statement one day and then all of a sudden, the next day, Lebo is back for good.
Laurie, this is the first stage of grief. It's called denial. You're going to have to work through it. I believe the next one is bargaining, then there's anger, depression, and then eventually acceptance. And we'll help you work through it. A part of that acceptance is going to have to be looking at the list of names involved for the job to take over from Rafa. Gary Monk's favourite. I wonder how that name sits with you.
Well, from what I've heard, Gary Monk is favourite amongst the bookies, but he's really not in the frame, according to the club. Do you know what? I think at the moment, many Newcastle fans are really going to struggle to try and get behind any name, to be honest. I know there's been talk, if the takeover happens, of Jose Mourinho. I think a lot of fans will take that as an insult, really. Just not in terms of course, Jose Mourinho's very capable manager, has won lots of things in the game. But it's almost a case of, you know, we had that in Rafa Benitez and it wasn't enough. And I think the saddest thing as well is it probably wouldn't have been all that difficult to persuade him to stay. I don't think he would have wanted the $12 million from China. As I understand it, it wasn't a money issue. It wasn't even necessarily transfers. But the thing is that, you know, they could have paid him more than he was asking for just to extend for 1 year, because if Ashley is really determined to get this sale through, and I think this is what a lot of fans now are struggling to accept, is if he had been determined to get this sale through, then surely the club is more valuable with Rafa Benitez on board, and then surely in that case it's worth just giving him a little bit extra money so that you can get that 50 million extra for the club when you sell it, and get the club sold quickly. I mean, it goes without saying that without Rafa, I think now it really doesn't feel optimistic about the takeover, irrespective of whether it goes through. Obviously, we still want rid of Ashley, but I mean, it's just casualty after casualty at the club, and it's hard to feel optimistic about anything going forward when Ashley hasn't been consistent in his whole time at Newcastle.
Let's try and be optimistic and look back at Rafa Benitez's time, because the kind of the easy and obvious thing to say about Newcastle under Rafa Benitez, you're always going to find a well-organised side, well set up. As someone who probably knows Newcastle a little better than that, what would you say were his qualities that made him so attractive to the Newcastle fans?
Well, just everything, James. He bought into the city. I remember being at the last game of the season. We'd already gone down. We were playing Tottenham. Arsenal fans will remember this one as well. We were playing Tottenham at home. And somehow we came out and played the performance of the season. We beat them 5-1. But even more than that, I remember that game because that was obviously the game when, right at the start of Rafa's tenure, everyone was really hoping that he was going to stay. And honestly, from the kickoff until half time, the only song that was sung was Rafael Benitez. And I just think that everything that he does off the pitch as well, you know, he's bought into so much of the local community, and he really is kind of it's like chalk and cheese with him and Ashley. He wants to be in the city, he wants to be part of the football club, and I've also got no doubt that he'll be immensely disappointed today at not being able to sign some sort of extension, because he really did, in the same way he did when he was at Liverpool, really bought into the city and felt like he was representing it every day, and acted with the passion that the fans had, and that's why they had such a phenomenal relationship with him.
Laurie, I remember why I spent a bit of time this morning reading various bits of quotes from players, and I know they were all desperate for him to stay. Do you think this might see a bit of an exodus? Are there going to be guys like Jamal Lascelles who might just go, actually, you know what, this isn't worth my time anymore?
Well, I think it's definitely, you know, that's put a bullet in the idea of being able to sign Rondon again. Jamal Lascelles, obviously in the past, he's been slightly inconsistent, but he's still young and has been sought after by some bigger clubs who maybe don't have, the best options at centre-back. The person that I really feel sorry for, actually, is Miguel Almiron, who's obviously come in January as the long-awaited transfer record-breaking signing. Yeah. And he's come in, and I spoke to Roberto Rojas, who works at BN in America, who broke that story on Twitter. I spoke to him yesterday, and he was saying to me that he doesn't actually think there's any sort of clause in Almiron's contract based on the security of Benitez or not. So he's now tied down to a contract till 2023, when other people such as Iosi Perez, etc., you know, might be leaving the club very imminently when Rafa's not there. And he's essentially expected to be the talisman for a club that, quite frankly, and I think a lot of Newcastle fans would say this, could easily now be in the Championship in a year's time.
Laurie, I can hear the disappointment and stress in your voice. I'm going to let you go. And I recommend a cup of tea and you can work through it. You'll be all right, I promise. I'll speak to you soon anyway. That's Laurie Karius there, a Newcastle United fan and a very distressed one, as I'm sure there are loads out there today. Just reading the comments on Twitter, lots of very angry Newcastle fans, as you can imagine, angry at Mike Ashley, who has today let Rafa Benitez go. Let us know what you think at Love Sport Radio on Twitter, Facebook or Instagram. You can also drop us a WhatsApp on 0208 70 20 558. What or indeed who next for Newcastle?
Love Sport.
That wasn't a World Cup last 16 in terms of the behaviour that I want to see from footballers. You know, this is going out worldwide. And I can't stand here and say that I particularly enjoyed it. My players didn't enjoy it. At half-time, they were confused about the actions, about what they should do. They kept the concentration fantastic. They did the job. But the image is going out worldwide about how to act. There's a young girls that's playing all over the world that are seeing that behaviour. For me, it's not right. And I can't stand here and say it's fantastic, it's brilliant, we're into the last 16. There's a bigger picture, there's a quarter final, sorry, there's a bigger picture here. There's a certain standard of behaviour that you've got to do. My players did that, and I'm proud.
Phil Neville there, England head coach, talking about the behaviour of Cameroon players. Clearly not happy, and rightly so. A pretty relentless display of violent behaviour from the Cameroon side. Look, they were frustrated. And I think that's clear and understandable when your decisions don't go your way or you feel you've been wronged. They weren't wronged, but they felt that they were. And this is a motivational tactic sometimes in sport. You know, we sometimes call it creating a siege mentality. Making your players feel like the world is against them can be a really good way to galvanise them and to really sort of, what's the word? I suppose just bring them together and also to motivate them. You look at the likes of Tom Brady's or Bill Belichick's. They are people who run pretty much solely on the idea that the world is against them. And there's a lot of people like that. Very successful people in politics, in business, in any walk of life who believe that the world is against them. And it's a successful tool. The world was not against the Cameroon side last night, I'm afraid. And their behaviour was, and I struggle to disagree with Phil Neville, pretty despicable. Although, I would also point out that Phil Neville himself wasn't averse to the odd, the odd big tackle, the odd leaving the little shoulder or elbow on someone. You know, he's a guy who certainly put his weight around, put it that way, when it came to football. So I think it's a little hypocritical, but you can understand his frustration. You know, Steph Houghton was playing the match last night and she couldn't attend press because she had a lot of ice on her ankle after that tackle, which we all saw. Look, Cameroon probably should have finished with nine men, probably. Well, women, I suppose, sorry. That's terrible, isn't it? But they should have had two red cards. You know, I think that's pretty clear. And they didn't. And that's a failing of the system as much as anything else. But then equally, they are judgment calls and those things go wrong. What is despicable is the way the game stopped. And actually, I was reading Peter Walton's column this morning, an ex-referee, a guy who's worked at the very highest level of officiating. And he pointed out that actually FIFA should have stepped in. You know, at a point where the game cannot resume because the players or the coaches or whatever have made it impossible for it to happen, actually, it should be a FIFA official, not one of the refereeing crew, who needs to step in and change and make sure that the game goes ahead. Let's have a listen to Rachel Yankee, friend of Love Sport and a former international. She was speaking to Sky Sports News and said she was pretty shocked by the reactions of some of the Cameroonian players.
I've never seen a game where people literally were breaking down on the pitch. I've never seen that before, but that's what happened. The game is over now, and England are through, and they play Norway. So, good luck to England, and the dream is still on.
The dream is still on. She's absolutely right, and I don't really want to devote too much airtime to what was, just a classic housery from Cameroon last night. I'm glad to say it failed. They didn't deserve to win the game. They deserve to lose. England move on, and they are starting to ramp up their performances, which is important, because I thought, and I said it at the beginning of the tournament, I thought they stuttered. I thought they stuttered out of the blocks. You know, they'd not actually been in great form. For all the She Believes Cup success, which was a big moment in Phil Neville's career, he said it made them believe they could beat the best teams in the world. For all of that success, they hadn't been in great form. They lost two of their four warm-up games, including the last one against New Zealand. They didn't seem to know what their best team was. I think Phil Neville is now a little bit closer to knowing what his best team is. And I think you saw something like that last night. I think that midfield three of Kira Walsh, Jill Scott and Frank Herbie, that seems to work. You can see what Jill Scott, the way she uses her body. I saw Tony Cascarino compare her to Mara and Fellaini, actually, which I thought was an interesting comparison and not an inaccurate one. You know, she's such an important linking tool in that midfield. And let's face it, England's front three of Nikita Paris, Ellen White and Tony Duggan. By the way, some of the things Nikita Paris does with the ball are absolutely sensational. You know, she had, I think it was Yvonne Luca at right back, who got booked very early on. And at one point she switched over to that side. And you could just see Luca was scared of her the whole time. And the same with Tony Duggan, who is still not fully fit. Ellen White links the attack so well. I didn't think she had a great game last night. But that front three, if they can get the ball to them, can get them the service, I think this England team can go a long way. That said, they will have to beat, and it will be at a later stage in the tournament, but if they beat Norway in the quarterfinals, and let's not underrate them, They will either face France or probably the USA. Now, I watched France-Brazil last night, and that French team have got some talent, I can tell you. I mean, everyone knows about Eugénie Le Sommer, and if you don't, go and watch her. She's 30. She's played 160 times for France in her career, a decade-long international career. She's been playing for a long time for Lyon, who are the best women's side in Europe. And I thought, I'll be honest, I don't watch a lot of women's football. You know, I have a lot of football to watch in my job, and not a lot of it is women's on a lot of occasions. And I wanted to watch Le Sommer over and over again because she was that good on the ball. They've got a lot of talent, I think, in a number of areas as well. You've got Kadidiatou Diani, who made these brilliant bursting runs last night. She set up France's first goal, the opening goal as well, breaking through on the right. Their finishing wasn't always great. I think they squandered a couple of chances. You know, the captain, Amandine Henry, she could have scored once or twice. But I think that France team are the ones to watch. You know, they impressed everyone on the opening night of the tournament. They came through it after extra time against Brazil. And I think they could beat the US in the quarters as well. And then England have got a job on their hands.
Love Sport.
This is the James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. We're here until 3:30 p.m. And here are your latest sporting headlines this afternoon. Rafa Benitez will leave Newcastle, the club have confirmed. His contract expires on June 30th. The 59-year-old had been in talks with club bosses over a new deal for months, but they failed to reach an agreement. In football, in other football news, England progressed to the quarterfinals of the Women's World Cup with a 3-0 victory over an enraged Cameroon side who protested after two VAR decisions went against them. Goals from Steph Houghton, Ellen White and Alex Greenwood sent England through to face Norway on Thursday. But a fractious game will be remembered for Cameroon's extraordinary reactions to White's goal and a disallowed effort from Ajara and Chu. After the game, England head coach Phil Neville said that he was far from impressed.
It didn't feel like football, I've got to be honest. And I know we get these briefs about coming on TV and just saying it was a good win. It was a good win. We played okay, we passed the ball well, we were ruthless in attack. We're ready to play in a quarter-final. But I've got to say that wasn't football for me.
Andy Murray's dream comeback from potentially career-ending hip surgery ended with a fairy tale triumph with playing partner Feliciano Lopez in the doubles at Queen's. Britain Murray and Spain's Lopez beat Britain Joe Salisbury and American Rajiv Ram 7-6, 5-7, 10-5. However, Murray is not putting a timescale on his return to the singles game.
If it happens in September or next year or in 6 weeks, I really don't mind. Like, genuinely, I do not mind. Like, I'm happy playing tennis and training and having no pain anymore.
This is the James Gray Show on Love Sport Radio. We're here until 3:30 p.m. It's 4 minutes past two and Bangladesh are 235 for 5. They've got just over 3 overs left of their innings. Mushfiqur Rahim doing his best to hit out, which I always think looks vaguely comical. For much as he's an incredibly talented cricketer, he's very, very short. I don't know exactly how tall he is, but he's certainly one of the more diminutive members of the international cricketing community. But he is right in amongst the runs once again. 77 from 82, trying to get Bangladesh up to a total of somewhere near 270. I think if they get 270 from here, they'll be very pleased indeed, but they will also think that they have a job to do. Much as Afghanistan haven't scored a lot of runs in this tournament, I think that they will still feel they need to get a few more on the board to make sure they are safe and don't get upset by a side who've really underperformed at this tournament. Someone who certainly hasn't underperformed since his comeback is Andy Murray, as you heard there. He triumphed at Queen's over the weekend. I don't think anyone in the world, quite possibly, can really have begrudged Andy Murray a doubles victory. I think Feliciano Lopez, his partner, spoke for us all when he said, "We're just so happy that you're back on a tennis court." Yeah, I think he's right. I know it's a bit soft to say it, but it's true. And in Murray's absence, the thing is, you know, this is part of the problem, that in Murray's absence, there hasn't been a huge amount of a step up elsewhere. Joanna Konsa had a brief moment in the sun. Carl Edmund sort of threatened to trampoline his way up the rankings, but never really stuck around for very long. So realistically, we've been crying out for Andy Murray to come back. Actually, British sport has been crying, and never mind British tennis, British sport, I think, has been pretty desperate for Murray to come back. Because he's this relatively unimpeachable character. There was that slightly ill-advised joke about supporting anyone but England in the football, but anyone in Scotland would understand that, you know, that old rivalry. There are not many people, though, even despite that, even football fans, there aren't many who would actually have a bad word to say about him. Hearts fans, maybe, because he's a Hibs fan. But, you know, really, he's a pretty clean-cut guy. He gets, I think, some abuse for being a bit dull. I actually don't think he's that dull. I've met him. I think he's quite a funny guy. He's a very dry sense of humour, and he's quite shy and quite quiet. But some people are like that. And, you know, when he gets fired up on court, it's not like Tim Henman's pathetic little fist pumped. You really believe in it. Yeah, he's a wholesome family man, but he's also got some fire in his belly, and we've also seen him cry. Yeah, we've seen all the different sides of Andy Murray. Much as you think he's quiet and he's a bit difficult, I don't think he is that. He's actually a pretty remarkable guy. And you know, former British tennis player Barry Cowan, he was speaking earlier, and he's equally impressed with his return to the sport.
I think it's a wonderful story. Obviously, it's still very early days in terms of what he can do in singles. But in the doubles court, he's looked fantastic. He's moved better and better. Great news that he's playing doubles at Wimbledon. He's got an amazing partner, Herbert. They've got a real possibility to do very well there.
He certainly has. And once we dispensed all the emotion, and, you know, there probably wasn't a dry eye in the house when Murray, you know, completed that victory with Lopez last night. Once we actually look at the facts of the matter, he's a former world number one. He's got a serve with plenty of pop in it, which doesn't seem to have gone away with the hip surgery. He's got really good touch at the net. He's always been a good net player. And he's not exactly going to be nervous going to big matches, is he? He's a legitimate threat to any Grand Slam doubles title he fancies going after. It almost doesn't matter who he plays alongside. But when you then look at Wimbledon, and he's playing with Pierre-Hugues Herbert, who is a previous champion in doubles, not at Wimbledon, but certainly in high-level tournaments. You know, he's a guy who knows his way around the doubles court. And when you then put him with someone like Andy Murray, I think he's someone who you absolutely, that team, you have to fear. You know, Herbert has won doubles at every single Grand Slam. And then he said he wasn't going to play with Nicolas Mahut, his normal partner this year, because he wanted to spend a bit more time with his family. But then Murray turned up, and he then said he couldn't say no. I don't blame him, because if you're a half-decent doubles player and then Andy Murray turns up at your doorstep and says, oh, do you fancy, do you think you could maybe play some doubles with me? It'd be great, yeah, but doubles, great, yeah. Of course you're going to say yes. Of course you're going to say yes, because he's one of the best players around and it's going to make you a very, very serious team. And, you know, he's also talking about playing mixed. I believe Kristina Mladenovic and Ash Barty both turned him down. But he talked up playing with the Williams sisters. He said, oh, I'd be up for that. They're both brilliant players. I don't know whether they'd be up for it or not. Can you imagine? If he teams up with Serena, they're going to embarrass people. Like, seriously, Andy Murray and Serena Williams would be one of the most dangerous mixed doubles partnerships out there. And I really hope they don't do it, because it would be embarrassing for everyone else, and they'll make the whole competition look very, very silly. Let's move on, shall we? England under-21s, of course, have been in action. Not very much positive action, let's be honest. And they're playing again tonight, taking on Croatia at 8 o'clock. Nick Mashita's been covering the under-21s through this tournament. Nick, is this a case of old-fashioned England overhype and then sort of anti-climax at the end?
It's certainly been an anticlimax. Yeah, they're all packing up here, ready to go home tomorrow. Unfortunately, they were expected to do a lot better, both obviously outside the camp, but especially inside the camp. You know, there's a lot of confidence, within the team, and they place an awful lot of expectation on themselves. I think we've addressed with Adi Boothroyd whether that confidence spilled into overconfidence and arrogance. I think there's probably a semblance of truth in that a little bit. You know, Dean Henderson and James Maddison coming out saying that they're a better team than France or Romania, having failed to beat either of them and losing to both of them last week. So, very, very disappointing. But as I said before, it was a tricky group. You can't just expect England to rock up and get to the, win the competition, which they haven't done since 1984 anyway. There's got to be a little bit of perspective in it, but they definitely have underachieved.
You've obviously seen them up close and personal. Where do you think it went wrong in those two games?
AD's been quite honest. He said he doesn't feel he would change too much, but obviously you look at the substitutions against France, which he made, and bringing on a couple of strikers and playing them wide. Well, you know, maybe they should have been shored up a little bit more. You know, I spoke to some coaches and some agents out here, and they were questioning them at the time as well. Leaving Phil Foden out, even we're not privy to obviously sort of how he is in the training sessions that we don't see or around the hotel. He might have been absolutely dead to the world following the France game, but he is the recognised best player. Scored an absolutely fabulous goal against France. So leaving him out, leaving him on the bench initially against Romania was a big call, and I think probably one that did backfire. But you look at the individual errors as well. You know, AD having told Hamza Chowdhury to go out and get himself sent off with an unbelievably reckless tackle, which did turn the tide a little bit against France. And he also didn't say to Wan Bissaka to slice it into his own net in injury time against France. So it's a collective failure, I guess, if you will.
In terms of AD Boothroyd's future, you know, I've seen people, I don't know, it felt reactionary to say that he should go, and maybe this is as much his fault as anyone else, but equally that is football management sometimes. Do you think the FA are likely to be knee-jerk like that?
No. It's only a month ago that AD signed a new 2-year contract extension to take him through to the next Euros. So, no, I don't think so. You look at 2015, Gareth Southgate, when he was in charge, they bowed out of the group stages, and I'm not saying obviously this is going to happen to AD, but I think less than 18 months later Gareth is in charge of the senior side. So look, I don't think they're going to suddenly turn around a month later and say, look, we're going to make a change. I'd be surprised, I really would be, whether AD was given assurances when he signed the new deal that regardless of what happened in this tournament he would continue. I don't know, No, I would be surprised if they change.
On the basis of what we've seen, what we know of this group of players, how good do you think they are? You know, is this a reality check for the amount of talent we've got at under 21 level?
Yes and no. I think you look at someone like James Maddison, who certainly underachieved and underperformed here individually. But you can look at Dean Henderson. I think he's only enhanced his reputation, even though so he conceded 6 goals in the final 15 minutes of games over here. He's possibly been, you know, one of the goalkeepers of the tournament in the group stages. So it is a really deep pool of talent. They've got 11 World Cup winners from the under 17s and the under 20s group from 2 years ago. 21s is a step up. Everybody is more or less playing men's football when they do step up to the 21 in these tournaments. So there's 9 I think you can go on and play in 2 years' time, including Sessegnon, Foden, Mason Mount, Reece Nelson. So this experience will only help them. They will be better for it. It might not feel like it right now, but hopefully it should stand them in good stead for 2021.
And just finally, because it's been such a big story back home, Aaron Wan-Bissaka and any potential move for him for Manchester United, AD, I think it was AD, who said that his head had been turned a little bit. Has there been any proper evidence of that, and has there been any follow-up to that sort of comment? Because I thought it was an odd thing for a manager to say, actually.
I think AD is genuine, and I think he's honest. I mean, he said, in the answer, he said, look, I did swear a bit, but I'm not going to. Yes, I do. And I think that's probably a degree of frustration from his point of view. 2 years ago in Poland, Jordan Pickford moved to Everton 2 days before the first game. And AD, I think, made a point. You know, we've got to read between the lines in certain things, but I think he made a point by saying that he was very happy with how Everton had handled that situation and dealt with them and worked with them. I think it was a little bit of a nod towards perhaps not being particularly happy with how things have developed with Wan-Bissaka this time round. You know, the evidence that we have for his head being turned was the performance on last week against France. It was a little bit error-strewn. We haven't spoken to him over here, so we can't get his his take on things and how he feels things have gone. But on the evidence of last week against France, then you'd be hard pressed to disagree with Eddie, really.
Yes, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with Eddie Boothroyd at any point in my life. I think it doesn't end well. But Nick, thank you so much for coming on. Great to have you here, Nick Mashter there. Midlands correspondent for the Press Association, but a man who obviously has been out in Italy covering that very disappointing England under-21s campaign. They play their final game in Serravalle, the San Marino Stadium, which is of course glamorous as anything really. They take on Croatia at 8 o'clock kickoff tonight.
This is Love Sport.
Not the best team we've ever had by a long shot, but it's not. They're actually a better team than they've played on this tour. They've just, I mean, the fastball is not fired at all. I mean, Rabada, you look at Rabada's, if his economy rate is much more than Morris's, and Morris was a replacement. So, you know, and then Ngidi's always had an injury cloud. So, you know, that hasn't helped. Dale Steyn going home, not helped. Nuki withdrawn before he got here. So, I mean, the plan was to keep bouncing people out like Jofra Archer does, but with the fastball is not performing. There was no plan B. So you go back to Imran Tahir, but he's only one.
Barry Richards there, former South Africa international, talking about their elimination from the Cricket World Cup. It's been an extremely disappointing one from a South African point of view. Just one win from their seven games. Let's speak to Neil Collins. He's a cricket writer out in South Africa. Neil, I'm sort of imagining the back pages of South African newspapers over the last, well, couple of weeks, frankly, have not been particularly positive ones.
No, it hasn't. It's very interesting, actually. It's not just the back pages, but the social networks have been absolutely laying into these guys because, like Barry Richards says, it's not the worst side you ever saw. They've definitely underperformed. A very, very interesting stat yesterday about Kagiso Rabada, who won the Under-19 World Cup 5 years ago. He's 24. He's bowled 10,000 balls in top-flight cricket. He's been overbowled. He's been pushed to the point of exhaustion, both mentally and physically. There's a lot of talk about that at the moment. Lunga Ndidi, a very, very good bowler. Petra Kwaya, good all-rounder. These three were supposed to be the backbone of a revolutionary new South African cricket team. And with Dale Steyn injured and Morne Morkel retiring quite early, it's hit hard. And you also got Hardis Fulyun, the fastest of them. He's now playing, you know, cold pack cricket in England. So it leads you having to almost kind of replace the team a little bit too early on the bowling front. But I don't think the bowling was the problem. I think it was the batting generally.
I was sort of minded of the game where South Africa chased down 370 in Durban about 3 years ago. I did a little comparison of the team that day and the team, for example, that lost to New Zealand. And seven of them were the same. It would have been eight if Steyn were there. Two others, I think Pretorius and Dumini, who played 3 years ago, were in the squad again. It doesn't feel like this South African side has actually progressed very much as a whole.
No, there's no question that the South African side hasn't progressed as we expected. If you got this young lad, Aidan Markram, who played a few games for Hampshire and did very well, he lives just down the road from me here. He was the captain of that under-19 World Cup winning side that everyone raved about. Mm. There's three or four players from that hanging around. I think that we have a very bad schedule in South African cricket. IPL takes preference over everything because it's so much money to South Africans. That means that we turned up a little bit late and a little bit underprepared. India were allowed to start the tournament late because of it, whereas we had two or three South Africans playing right to the end of the IPL. Then there's a slight pull all the time to take Kolpak and county cricket contracts, which pay more than South African contracts do. And provincial cricket in this country is in a mess. We had a terrible destruction of an international T20 that we were planning, a global T20 that fell apart. So, yes, it hasn't progressed. I don't think it's just the players. I think that the way cricket is run in South Africa is very, very poor. Sports governing bodies in South Africa tend to be run by the government as opposed to by sports lovers. So you'll find a lot of people running sport have never played the game. They don't really understand the game. So we're stuck with, and that's why AB de Villiers left, obviously. He left 3 years too early, in my view. So you're in a situation where your top performing cricketers are always looking elsewhere to make more money and to look at a more competitive environment. And we've really been caught in that vice between up-and-coming and developing cricketers not being done very well, and they're experienced and good cricketers in the side deciding to go and play for Essex for a year or for Hampshire just to make more money. So that certainly has kind of chipped away at what was the South African cricket team that was always competitive in the top four or five of the world, always seemed to choke when they got deep into a World Cup. And it's just taken that extra edge away. But certainly, as Barry Richards said, this is a team that should have performed a lot, lot better than this. They're ninth in that table. And I look at it and I'm watching Afghanistan and Bangladesh now, and I'm looking at the catches being dropped and some of the batting. South Africa are a lot better than ninth in this table. And I still think if they could just fire once, you know, and really set themselves alight, that guys like Hashim Amla, he's still got something in him. Markram with the bat, Faf du Plessis, as shown in this tournament. We've got this young lad, Rassie van der Dussen, who's also a very good cricketer coming up. I think that this is a South African side still capable of beating anyone, but not quite firing. I think there's a problem with Otis Gibson as well. I don't think he's quite caught the kind of feel of the team. I don't think he quite runs it the way that maybe he should. There's a lack of confidence in him. And to the point where you saw Quinny de Kock, he's a very, very talented wicketkeeper who hasn't had a great tournament but had a good IPL. You saw him complaining to Rabada about not putting the ball in short yesterday. Obviously, there's team orders being thrown out there that not everyone agrees with. So there's a whole list, a whole litany of problems with South African cricket. But I think the ultimate one, the top one, is the way that South African cricket is run. The Cricket South Africa is not run by top-class professional ex-cricketers. The funny thing being, of course, that the ICC is run by Dave Richardson, and South Africans have been at the top of that organisation for a while. But until we can run our sport properly, and we found this in football and rugby as well, you're not quite getting the development and the technical preparation, and you're not quite doing it right because it's being run by people who are more politician than sportsmen. And that's really where South Africa as a whole is struggling. We've had a bad Women's World Cup, a bad Under-20 World Cup, not done as well as we should have in the Under-20 Rugby World Cup, and the cricket is just the icing on the top. And the reception that the Proteas are going to get when they come home is going to be pretty mean, I think, and understandably so from the fans who believe that this side were going to go there and be, at worst, semi-finalists, I think.
Neil, thank you so much for your time and those strong views. I know it must be frustrating covering South African sport at the moment, especially with the way it's being run. Neil Collins there, a cricket writer based out in South Africa. Kieran Critchard, Love Sport's very own, joined me in the studio. And a Ben Anson impersonator this week. This is your job. You have to start complaining about not having a backside to sit on trains because Ben doesn't have a bum. He was born without a bum, so he just had to sit on his pelvis.
Ramesh Ranganathan also doesn't have a bottom.
Really?
Yeah.
That is unfortunate, isn't it? Bob Mortimer claims to have a backwards bottom, but that's for another day. Kieran, you've come in to talk some other cricket, but not South African.
No, we're looking ahead, obviously, to the big game. In my view, still the biggest game in cricket, despite the fact some people think it's India-Pakistan. It doesn't come close to England-Australia.
Those viewing figures are just complete projections.
And also, they have much bigger populations, so quite clearly, there are going to be more people that are going to watch those games. But big news going into tomorrow's game, perhaps not a surprise to many. Jason Roy's been ruled out of this game. He's struggling with his hamstring injury that he picked up against the West Indies on the 14th of June. And it's really, really concerning. From the moment that it was kind of revealed that he had torn his hamstring, you're automatically thinking in a World Cup that's only got 3 weeks to go now, that it is going to be very, very tight to get back. They said initially it was two games, but I never really bought that. I think that was kind of optimistic thinking. And England haven't really given much away with Jason Roy, and now he's been ruled out. There are serious concerns for me as to whether Jason Roy is going to make it back. And that, for me, gets the conversation rolling about a very certain Nottinghamshire batsman that has been suspended as to whether he comes back into this squad.
Yeah, Samit Patel's got a great... Oh, you don't mean Samit Patel. No, right. Alex Hales, yes. It would be an extremely bold move. This is what I learned when I used to work in politics, Kieran. I learned that if you're in a meeting with a civil servant and you wanted them not to do something, you just sort of puffed your cheeks out and went... I mean, that would be very bold, and they'd immediately bottle it. For me, this would be an extremely bold decision for the ECB, because they have said, well, they've said a lot of things, haven't they said, I read one week they said that he is technically available for selection, and then the next week that he wasn't.
He's been suspended indefinitely. There wasn't a time frame that was put on the suspension, and they said that obviously the team values, that Alex Hales have completely disregarded those. But then Owen Morgan's comments when kind of Jason Roy's injury came out to begin with, that he'd be out for at least two games, was he said he didn't really rule it out. He kind of suggested that he would ask the rest of the team. And that tells me that Owen Morgan isn't completely against the idea of him coming back in. Now, I can see both sides of it, but if England win this World Cup with Alex Hales coming back in 10 years' time, will we really care that Alex Hales was brought back in? It would certainly be a very bold call if he was to come back in. But for me, James Vince just doesn't do it at international cricket. He's not good enough. And if it means bringing back Alex Hales, who has been in the headlines for the wrong reasons over the last few years, he's a proven international opener at this level, scored plenty of one-day hundreds, he is certainly good enough to come in and make a difference. And if Jason Roy is going to be ruled out for the rest of the tournament, I would not be completely against Alex Hales coming back in.
I mean, there's also the issue that he doesn't play red ball cricket anymore, so he's not really been playing cricket at all. I don't think he's even played any twos cricket, has he? So he hasn't played a game since the 12th of May. He played for Notts. I mean, that it must be a concern for any selector, surely.
Exactly. Obviously, we're kind of in the middle at the moment of rounds of the county championship. So we're in four-day cricket. And as you said, Alex Hales is one of those that had signed an exclusive white ball contract with Nottinghamshire. And so he struggled for not just game time, but competitive, high-level game time. So that would be a concern. I don't think England will make that big decision. I think it's too bold a call at this stage. But I just sort of think England are under a bit of pressure now and they have to start getting results, and James Vince just isn't doing it at this level, and I just feel like it is worth the risk of bringing Alex Hales in. Whether that would rock the boat, that's the big question. Will the rest of the squad be happy for him to come in? If they're not, and that starts to create cracks, that's exactly what England don't want. It's the last thing that Owen Morgan will want from his squad, is divisions within the camp.
I mean, it is traditional for England at a major tournament to,
yes,
you know,
exactly,
sort of fall apart of their own volition. If Hales doesn't come in, what are the options? I mean, I've campaigned for Joe Root to open the batting, but Nick Friend on the Inside Edge on Thursday nights here on Love Sport, he was pointing out that, well, Root's probably the best ODI number three in the world at the moment. Why mess with that? Do England have other options that aren't Alex Hales or James Vince shaped?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think the two batsmen that have been around the camp in ODI cricket over the last few years are Dawid Malan and Joe Denley. Ben Duckett is, I think, one of the kind of other names, obviously at Nottinghamshire as well, moved from Northamptonshire at the end of last year. He is an exciting young player. Now, he found it tough over in Bangladesh and India in the Test series.
I mean, it's a hard place to bat.
Exactly. He found it tough, but in home conditions, I don't think Duckett would be the worst thing. Now, whether he's been very rarely in England camps, only really at T20s over the last few months, so maybe they would go more to familiarity with Milan and Denley, who've been in there. But I wouldn't discount Duckett. But obviously, this is assuming that Jason Roy is out for the rest of the tournament, but the way it's going, it is starting to becoming a real concern that he might be ruled out for the rest of the tournament.
Well, yes, and we start to hear whispers that he might well be, and it's starting to look that way. Duckett is what an interesting one, because he's a guy at the beginning of the summer, I said, if he scores two or three county championship tons, he's a guy who could open the batting with Rory Burns. Now, he hasn't done that. He last got 100 back at the beginning of June for Notts against Warwickshire, I think it was, when following on. On not an easy pitch, by the way, because they were bowled out for 97 in the first innings. So, you know, he's obviously in some form. He did chuck a pint over Jimmy Anderson's head, though, in Australia. And maybe that might count against him. Where are all the opening batsmen who don't have dodgy disciplinary records? Can we just have...
Or that are good enough to play international cricket. We haven't really had one of those.
No.
International, I say Test cricket. Obviously, ODIs, they've been fine, but
I'll
Test
tell you,
cricket.
Well, the problem is that I know a bloke who's extremely clean-cut. He's got a brilliant record in international cricket. He's a lovely man. Everyone likes him, and he scores millions of his runs, and his name rhymes with Ballister Wook.
This is Love Sport.
Here are your latest sporting headlines. England's women are into the quarterfinals of the Women's World Cup after beating Cameroon 3-0 in a game full of VAR controversy. The Lionesses will play Norway in the quarterfinals on Thursday. Andy Murray won the doubles final at Queen's yesterday alongside Spanish partner Feliciano, or Deliciano, as Mrs. Murray calls him, I believe, Lopez, who also won the singles title. Rafa Benitez will leave Newcastle when his contract expires at the end of the month after both parties failed to reach an agreement. And Jason Roy is out of England's Cricket World Cup game tomorrow against Australia at Lords. He's trying to recover from a hamstring injury he picked up against the West Indies. England, of course, are looking to bounce back from defeat to Sri Lanka on Friday. This is the James Gray Show on Love Sport. I'll be with you until 3:30 p.m. And we get to speak now to Chris Jones, which is always a pleasure. A tennis writer for the Sunday Times. Also covers rugby, by the way. Chris, there's nothing Chris Jones can't do, as far as I know. Chris, have you got anything to put to that? Anything you can't do?
Well, I can't boast that I've got a metal hip. But if I'm going to get a metal hip, I want the one that Andy's got.
I think that's very sensible. How good was he over the course of the week?
It's ridiculously good, isn't it? I mean, he's back. We can all breathe. We can breathe easily again now. And Edmund will be going, thank goodness for that. No, nobody's going to be looking at me as the only sort of British hope anymore. Andy's back. Sir Andy's back. And it was just wonderful to see that desire, that inability to just let things ride. He wants to win. Whatever he's playing, he wants to win. And you could see he was carrying Feliciani, who was out on his legs. He had played so much tennis. And he was carrying him through that final. And it was just great to see. He had so much to the British tennis vista, you know, that you've got Sir Andy out there playing for us. And he used to polarise opinion, didn't he? Now people can see he's just a really, really good competitor and a good bloke.
Yeah, I think you're right. He did used to polarise, and I wonder if that anyone but England comment sort of played against him. But now we've seen him happy, we've seen him sad, and I don't think anyone didn't want him to win that doubles title. In terms of his physical state, you know, he said that he doesn't know about singles, and obviously movement is going to be an issue one way or another. Did he look at any point hampered?
No, he had one big tumble, and we all went, oh, no, you know, here we go. He's going to need sort of three or four people to carry him up now, but he just bounced back up again. And he said himself, you know, this is mental, you know. I'm playing with a metal hip, I'm diving around, and I don't feel any pain. And it used to be awful, you know, just to watch him limping around the court, you know. It's you know, you see, it's like watching a great sort of horse at Aintree, sort of unable to get over the fence anymore because, you know, the fetlock's gone. You think, I'll just put him down. You know, I'm sorry, they can't compete anymore. Now, no one's going to put Andy down, but the fact is, he was a limping sort of ghost of his former self. And now, he's bouncing around the court. You know, okay, you could probably improve his serve a bit more, but that will come with all the movement and confidence. Because remember, his body has been acting in a totally alien way for so long because it's been carrying one half of him, which didn't work. So now he can get back to sort of the movement we know he's got, this natural panther-like movement around the court. He's always had those brilliant hands where he can play shots other people can only dream about. And so, yeah, will he be back to singles? Well, he's got this big decision to make now, isn't he? Does he concentrate on doubles, or does he take a longer break after Wimbledon and try and get ready for the US Open, which is a tournament that first launched him onto the world stage when he won the boys' title there? And, of course, he won the Grand Slam there as well to set off this fantastic story. So it's a really big pull for him to try and play singles at the US Open. But does he want to race that far ahead? I hope he takes just a little bit slow. He's only 32. Look, people are winning titles at 37 this weekend.
Yeah.
He's got another 5 years to play.
Yeah, which I think, I find that watching Andy Murray quite exhausting. I imagine being Andy Murray is even more exhausting, and I dread to think what 5 more years might do to him. But he's always a guy I've thought, you know, is addicted to tennis. You know, he can't live without it, it almost seems. And that seems to come across on court, and it's why people like watching him. What was the crowd reception like at Queen's? I imagine it was almost delirious excitement as opposed to the sometimes sympathetic excitement you get with British tennis crowds.
Oh, very much so, because, you know, you hope that this isn't just, you know, our last farewell. He's just going to sort of play a couple of good rounds of doubles and then give us a cheery wave. Well, the fact is, the crowd was sort of willing him to win, and they were willing to a certain extent that at the end of this massive explosion of emotion, he won, you know. Thankfully, no tears on court for a change, because it was a different sort of Andy's reaction. There was the smile, which is always, you know, rare to see. But, you know, there was a real sort of outpouring of sort of, he's back. And I think that would be mirrored throughout the whole of British tennis, because he has become this iconic person for us, this player who's dragged us into world contention again after being in the doldrums for so long, being the almost there through the Rozetsky and Henman years of getting to a final, getting to semifinals and never actually doing it. He actually won Grand Slams and, you know, became world number one and gave us the ability to walk tall in tennis, where
quite honestly, the rest of the tennis vista in Britain is not that fantastic, you know. But then again, we have to remember that he is only our British number six in singles, and he's only our British number eight in doubles, so we must have some other players out there, Jed.
Well, I can only hope so, Chris. I can only hope so. He's obviously going to go play doubles now with Pierre-Hugues Herbert, who is not just some bloke he found who didn't have a partner. You know, he has won all the Grand Slams. He's got a career doubled slam. Surely Murray will go in as favourite on the back of that sort of form.
Well, there will be a lot of betting for him because, you know, Herbert has agreed to play with him and completely upset his normal partner, Nicolas Mahut, the Iron Man of Wimbledon, the guy who plays these three-day matches. He's not happy. But Herbert thought, you know, I wasn't due to be playing. I've got a chance to play with Andy Murray. And, you know, Murray will say, oh, well, you know, we'll just see how it goes. He won't be just seeing how it goes. He knows he's playing with one of the top doubles players in the world. And he himself is an outstanding doubles player, as we've seen in Davis Cup. Before that, he's popping down. He's at Eastbourne at the moment. And he's going to be partnering another world number one doubles player, Marcelo Melo of Brazil. So he's not exactly playing with some duds here. He's very cleverly picking some of the best players, doubles players, ever to pick up a racket. And no doubt he will eventually, once one of the women decides, yes, we can take the pressure of being Andy's partner, he will also be playing mixed at Wimbledon.
I can't quite believe that he's genuinely considering playing mixed with Serena, which would just be unfair. Like, I don't think that should be allowed, because Serena and Andy Murray, they'll just crush people, won't they?
Absolutely. It would just, Jamie's ruled the roost in the mixed doubles at Wimbledon. Mm. It's his manner. And, you know, it must be very strange for Jamie now. You know, he's finally come out of the shadow of his brother as one more Grand Slams, and his brother became a world number one before his brother. And now his brother moves into his manner, into his doubles area. It must feel, oh, will you just stick to singles? You know, I'm doing pretty well alone here, making a name for myself as Jamie Murray. I don't want to be, oh, yeah, and you also play just like your brother Andy, which it could be the way he's going in doubles.
Very much so. Chris, thank you very much for coming on. Always a pleasure to speak to you. Chris Jones there, tennis writer, also covers rugby as well. Always worth a read, Chris, on almost anything he writes about, quite frankly, for Sunday Times or other places. Also worth mentioning, by the way, that we have a new women's world number one in Ash Barty, the first Australian women's world number one since Yvonne Goolagong way back 40 years ago. And Barty's story is worth just pausing on, because 3 years ago, she signed up for the qualifiers at Eastbourne. So it wasn't even Eastbourne, by the way. It was the Eastbourne Trophy. It was the Eastbourne Trophy, which is like the sort of the one below. It's almost like the amateur tournament for the big tournaments. You know, the prize fund, I think, was $50,000. She was an absolute nobody when it came to tennis. She was someone who had played professional cricket in Australia and then took to tennis because she felt that she was better at it. She had been a much vaunted junior player. I think she won the girls singles at 15, but it didn't quite work that way. But she is now world number one. Andy Murray tried to get her to play mixed with him and she turned him down. So that's always good. That's a good position to be in when you're turning down Andy Murray. She's also a great player to watch, a really entertaining player. Someone I know that George Belshaw, the co-host of the Love Tennis podcast here with me, is very keen on as well and enjoys watching. And she will go into Wimbledon as world number one, having beaten Yulia Gorgas to win the title in Birmingham this week. And who knows, she might hang on to it for a decent amount of time too.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.